It is just past 8:08 in the morning, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas. As Hurricane Florence crashes into the Atlantic coast, it brings into heightened relief one of the worsening realities of climate change, the millions more of us constantly finding ourselves on the front lines of extreme weather. Florence is modeling itself after another hurricane, last year's Hurricane Harvey, in its commitment to simply stay put and dump heretofore unprecedented amounts of water onto the land and into the air. Harvey is tied with Katrina as the costliest tropical cyclone ever recorded anywhere and the wettest tropical cyclone to ever hit the United States. Starting in late August of last year, it dumped a year's worth of water on Houston and the surrounding areas in a matter of just days, reaching the highest total rainfall in the nation's history, nearly 61 inches near Port Arthur, Texas, about 90 miles east of Houston. Port Arthur and Houston are also the nation's oil, gas, and petrochemical hub. Low-income communities of color, including many immigrant communities with long histories of environmental injustice, were newly inundated with toxic releases from chemical plants, refineries, intertwined oil, gas, and chemical pipelines, holding tanks, and more. Last month, on the August 25th one-year anniversary of Hurricane Harvey, I attended a People's Tribunal on Hurricane Harvey Recovery in Houston. There, participants discussed not only ongoing impacts, but also on the process of what it means to have a just recovery, particularly for those living in the hardest-hit communities, many of whom are far from recovered today. The tribunal looked specifically at environmental justice, workers, immigrants, housing, and the environment, with firsthand reports from impacted community members, service providers, and experts. It also focused on what it means to have a just recovery, which takes into account not only the recovery of those communities, but their betterment moving forward. This is the first of a two-part series taking a deep dive into Hurricane Harvey. We start with People's Tribunal organizer Zoe Middleton with the organization Texas Housers, providing low-income housing services.
Disaster recovery is an extraordinarily long process for low-income folks and communities of color, and we want to offer a counter-narrative to what we see as this very happy, like, we've recovered, 1 year later, we're Houston strong. We're all back to normal. We're going to pass a massive bond that will solve a lot of our flooding problems. And we wanted to kind of pump the brakes on that narrative and explore the ways that people are still suffering from the storm and also the more historical causes of the storm that started occurring way before Harvey ever hit.
Among those who testified at the People's Tribunal is Sarahi Garcia, a retired nurse. She and close friend Rosie Soto founded and led the Aftermath Pop-Up Project, providing with other volunteers much-needed services to the hard-hit community of Lakewood in Houston.
The Lakewood community is in the northeast side of Houston. It's in the area we call the east side. And traditionally, that's where you're going to find your refineries and your landfills, your chemical plants, anything like that. So it's an area where we live environmental racism.
And you are a nurse?
I am a retired nurse, but I worked as a nurse for 15 years. I worked for the Harris County Hospital District in their community clinics program. And I also worked for a long-term acute care facility here in Houston where we dealt with infectious diseases. And I dealt with the same things that were in the actual water. So these are the things that we would have to gown up and put masks on to go and see a patient. But yet, this was what was in the water.
So you're talking about the water that came into the Lakewood community during Hurricane Harvey. Tell us a little bit more about the community itself of Lakewood. Who are the people who live there?
So the people in Lakewood are what we would call lower income people of color community. And I guess you can say a lightly documented community. And so they're really disenfranchised. And actually in that community, never floods. But this time it did because they opened the floodgates. So there was no advanced warning. The waters came rushing in the middle of the night and people didn't know this was coming. And I saw, I live in Richmond, and which is right next to Sugar Land, Texas. And if anybody knows about Sugar Land, Texas, that's one of the wealthiest areas in the whole state of Texas. So they have a very good irrigation and drainage system. There are no landfills there. And the state took the courtesy of going and knocking on doors to make sure people were evacuated and did were organized and had a contingency plan to take care of those people. But here in the Lakewood community, nobody came. They never saw fire. They never saw police. They never saw National Guard. They never saw any of these other organized, rescue efforts like the Cajun Navy or anything like that. They did not see that in those communities. So they were really left to fend for themselves. And actually, people were trying to go into those neighborhoods to help. But the police were not letting anyone go into those neighborhoods to help. So that begs the question as to why would you stop people from going into rescue? Because there was a lot of people that saw what was happening and wanted to do something, because it's, if you have a boat, if you have a, canoe, whatever, people were using mattresses to rescue other people. So it was a sense of, you could basically feel the hate towards us. And it was a sense of just this utter sense of not being able to do and bring and take care of and have the resources. And it was a complete sense of helplessness. And no matter how much we asked for help, no one was coming.
Tell me, what were the environmental conditions on top of water? So there were releases from the waste facilities, there were refinery releases. Tell me what else was there besides water.
We did know that there was arsenic, there was typhoid, lead, mercury, and they said unspecified heavy metal. That's another thing. There was MRSA. MRSA is flesh-eating bacteria. MRSA basically, how can I explain this? This is the worst kind of infection. That means that you've been treated with every antibiotic and you cannot get rid of that infection. So MRSA was in the water, and we had people that are diabetics or that have mobility issues or what have you, that were sitting in this water, a toxic stew, and sitting there for hours upon hours and being exposed to this flesh-eating bacteria. And yet that it wasn't a concern for the city.
And you think that came from the sewage facilities, the refineries? Where do you think it came from?
There's a landfill, the community sits on the base of the landfill. So basically everything came down. And then there's a bayou that runs in the neighborhood. And that, everything came out, that was sewage and anything you can think of. This neighborhood has just been traditionally neglected, right? So after the hurricane, whatever stuff had been dumped in that bayou, it all came, everything was lifted up. And not only that, but we were actually there just a couple days ago. There's still an air mattress on the tree that's been there since Harvey, right? And the city, and that just goes to show you how neglected, that literally has been there for a year.
You're a nurse, so tell me some of the symptoms that people were reporting during, after Harvey, and how long those symptoms have persisted.
Immediately after Harvey, within 2-3 days, it was skin issues from the immediate exposure to the toxic water. We had one of the residents had to take their child to the hospital because of this, a rash. And to this day, these kids, they still have the rash, and the doctors just say it's a virus. It's a virus. So we're still dealing with the ramifications from it. But the thing is that we know that this is just the tip of the iceberg. What's going to happen in 5 years from now, in 10 years from now, in 20 years from now? Because we were exposed to carcinogens. And this is not gonna pop up from one day to another. This is gonna take. So, my biggest concern is with this community that's disenfranchised. First of all, a lot of them don't have insurance, health insurance, and if they do, they don't have enough money to pay for the co-pays or to go get that MRI or whatever it is that they have to get. So they don't go to the doctor. And they self-treat. So these things exacerbate and become worse. And say if we have a strain of some kind of a virus, it can mutate and get stronger. And that's what people don't realize, that the things that we were exposed to, like our body does not have a defense for these things. So what can happen is that these things can mutate and become worse. And my concern is that the city is acting like everything's okay and that people are doing just fine, but we're not. People are having a really hard time. And one of the things that I keep bringing up is PTSD, because nobody's talking about this. We heard stories like the stories the children have are so traumatizing to myself that I have PTSD and I didn't live this. So you have these babies that can't even really express, you know, to you what it is that they are going through, what they're feeling. But you see the manifestations of anxiety when it starts to rain. You see they ask those questions of like, should we go somewhere else and stay? You know, they just feel insecure. And the thing is that, how can we give them the security when they saw what played out? How can we make them feel comfortable? Like, and how can we assure that this is not going to happen to them again? And I myself cannot give those reassurances. And it's really hard to hear these things and say, I am sorry, but I don't know what else to tell you. You know, what can I do? For the only thing that I know to do is be vocal and be loud about it. But even with that, you know, with that being said, it's you need more than one voice. You know, for as loud as I can get, I need people behind me also asking the mayor and asking Judge Ed Emmett to do the right thing.
Sarahi's partner in the Aftermath pop-up project is Rosie Soto, better known as Mama Rosie. The services that Sarahi and Mama Rosie provided were critical for those in Lakewood. They included food, water, hot meals, hot coffee, rebuilding supplies, and simply a friend to say hello to every day in the neighborhood.
It's been a year since Hurricane Harvey, but you're still providing this service. The city is saying that the city has recovered from Harvey. What are you seeing in the neighborhoods that you've been working in and in Lakewood?
They're not really recovered. I mean, a small percentage of them, because they may have received limited help from certain type of organizations. I can't name which organizations those were. But there are still significant amounts of houses that have been abandoned. So the neighborhoods are not fully recovered. And if anybody in the city is saying, yes, we're okay, that is a big lie. I'll tell you that is a lie, because I go out into these neighborhoods on a weekly basis, if not every other week. So I still see people that have tents up in their driveways that are still cooking on Coleman stoves. And these are people, you know, I know one couple where the husband is disabled. And so it's only one income coming into the house. The kid, anytime it starts to rain, any significant rain, he starts getting really, really anxious and starts crying because he's thinking that he's not going to see his dad again for 3 days. His dad actually had to sit inside their house, did not want to leave the house, sent the mom and the kids out to a shelter, and then he stayed and he sat he put a chair on top of a table and put a bucket on top of the chair, and that's how he survived the floodwaters in his home. And he didn't want to leave because there's theft in the neighborhood, and he didn't want somebody to come in and ransack his home while he had escaped out so he wouldn't die. So he almost died there in his house himself, you know, and his poor kid is traumatized for life because he didn't know of his father for 3 or 4 days, you know, consistently asking his mother, where's my dad? Where's my dad? Where's my dad? And there was no way to confirm whether the gentleman was dead or not.
And you think that there's still so much, there's still such a lack of recovery in these communities because they started out already in a position of lacking resources. They didn't receive the same type of help during the storm as other communities, and they still haven't gotten the help. You know, why is it that at a year later there's still this great need?
I have found in my own experience in talking to these families and, you know, and just standing on the outside, really, looking into the situation, a lot of it has to do with people are afraid to ask for help because they're either lightly documented to non-documented people. You know, when the flooding happened, as Sarahi mentioned, FEMA, nor the Red Cross, nor the National Guard, nor the police, nor the fire department came out into these neighborhoods. And I can vouch for that because I was out there every single week, and I was out there several days during the week. And I never saw, in the Lakewood community, and I never saw those people out there. The only time that I saw was maybe a month and a half into after the Hurricane Harvey had hit, was a Red Cross truck that was out on the main road, on Mesa Road, handing out some food. I had one of the community members show me what they were serving, and literally what they were serving was a bun with a small soy patty, and that's it. There was nothing else on the plate and no drink. That was it. That's all they were serving. So people were afraid to ask for help. We understood that there were FEMA trailers and Red Cross trailers that were asking for documentation in order to get help. And that's a huge humanitarian violation right there.
Next, we hear from both Sarahi and Rosie together.
I think they don't understand the systemic racism in our government and how that affects our recovery effort. I think they don't understand what environmental racism is. I don't think they've even heard the term of environmental racism. So I think that there's a lot of lack of knowledge of, in general, our societal problems and how they affect in these circumstances.
Yes. So, yes, it's unfortunately, I agree with Sarahi and what she's saying. You know, it's just a case of circumstances where the society has been led to believe that thing. And that's really, without elaborating more on what I was just going to say, that's just a common way of thinking in this country, period. Things are always something not quite real. You know, there's a lot of like sugarcoating things. And so when disasters like this happen, I think it's difficult for people to wrap their heads around the severity of what's happened, you know, and especially if they're not present right there to see it happen. It's kind of hard to comprehend, you know, because maybe you haven't gone through it. Maybe you've never been through a natural disaster. But let me tell you, we're living it day to day here, and some of these families are living it day to day still a year later. And let me give an example of how devastating the storm was. Let's think back to Louisiana and Katrina. We still have, there are still community members from Louisiana, from New Orleans, that were given FEMA trailers to stay in after Hurricane Katrina, and they are still living in those trailers. How many years ago was that? 13 years ago now? Okay, what makes people think that Houston has recovered in a year? That is just not realistic. I don't know who's feeding you in the information, but they're feeding you very incorrect information.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to us, because like I said, we feel like our voices have been neglected.
One of the youngest people to testify was Judith Nieto.
Hello, my name is Judith Nieto, and I grew up in the community of Manchester here in Houston. And I'm hearing all these stories, and I mean, this is something that we see and live through every year, every hurricane season. My family gets really nervous. We don't know if we should leave or we should stay. Usually, the community doesn't flood, but we're surrounded by industry, so a lot of the times the industries lose power and they malfunction during rains and during the hurricanes. And so there's a lot of emissions after and during the events. My family usually gets really sick right after. But during Harvey, I actually wasn't here, but I was on a text message thread with my family, constantly giving them alerts. Because I'm on the outside, I'm looking at all the news, and I'm getting all these alerts for all these refineries that are malfunctioning and all of these different events that they're not aware of. But by then, they couldn't leave because everything around them was flooded. So they were trapped in Manchester under this toxic plume. And still, since then, the refineries have not been the same. They continue to malfunction constantly, and there's always explosions. This is things that we see every day, you know, people in the community just kind of learn to deal with it and accept it. And a lot of the times they don't know how to engage in changing these things happening because they see it happen so often, and they see it just go under the rug and see that the elected officials and the people that could potentially say something or change something don't do anything at all and just tell the people that it'll be fine and that they're safe and that the refineries that they're living next to are the safest in the country and that they're going to expand and they're going to offer more jobs and the people living in the communities will actually be able to have those jobs. So, you know, people just kind of let it go. But I do see that more and more young people are becoming more anxious and nervous about being in the neighborhood because they see that their parents, their grandparents are getting more sick. There's more cancer rates. We have families, generations of families dying from cancer, grandmothers, kids, of the same family that grew up in that community. And, you know, that's a scary thing to think about when you're living in a community where you can't really afford to live anywhere else. And with development happening all around the city, it's just becoming more and more expensive. And so there is no other place to live. Manchester is predominantly Latino community. A lot of undocumented people live there, as you probably heard earlier, and a lot of low-income people live there. So they don't really have the resources to just pick up and leave. And so now you add a climate disaster, you know, it's just unthinkable. They're not able to have that capacity to think about what that would look like. And I mean, just it doesn't seem like more people outside of Manchester really realize how impacted the whole city is. You know, it's not just an issue of Manchester or like just them dealing with these issues. It's the whole city. Like, we're all living under this nasty benzene cloud. And the sky hasn't been the same. I don't know if you've noticed that. This isn't just an issue of climate change or environmental injustices. This is migration, immigration, you know, and all of these other isms that we're dealing with because of institutional racism and because of environmental racism and not acknowledging the people that are most impacted and how they are working together to actually create a good network of people to be able to support each other. But thank you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for offering space to be able to testify.